Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today, Dan Snow is talking about 1918, 100 Days to Victory.
The Germans had combed through all their forces and, rather stupidly in retrospect, picked out every single one of their best troops and created these stormtrooper units that were absolutely elite and brilliant. But it left all their other units bereft of all their best soldiers. And these men were all thrown into battle. It did very well. They advanced dozens of miles on the first day and more after that. But those stormtroopers got exhausted. They were told to just bypass strong points, infiltrate, keep moving forward, collapse the front, which was fine, except they end up advancing in all sorts of different directions, and you lose your strategic thrust. It doesn't have quite the direction that you need. And so the German army found itself controlling a lot more territory, but it just ended up that they had a lot more, a baggier, longer front line they now had to defend. They didn't achieve a massive, decisive breakthrough. So on the 21st of March, that attack begins. 38,000 British soldiers, which includes 21,000 prisoners, were casualties on that one day. It's the second day of the British Army in the whole of the First World War. They advance further, but then their attack peters out for all the old reasons that we talked about in past the First World War. It's very difficult to keep the supplies up. It's very difficult to get over the beaten zone, the battlefield. You can't lay a new railway track fast enough. You can't get the trucks and vehicles across. They're not solid enough. You can't bring the artillery pieces up. So the Germans launched other attacks in other sectors. Each enjoyed some success, but each eventually bogged down. And in the end, the Germans lost 700,000 men by the summer. And the Allies lost more, but those Allied men could be replaced with the Americans, British and French, and their munitions and tanks could be replaced as well. It was more difficult to replace German equipment. Now, the time went, we're going to start the 100 days. In fact, we're not even going to start the 100 days, and we're already into the talk. I've got to speed up a bit here. The vital precursor to the 100 days is the Australian action at Hamel, which many think is the first modern battle in history. Now, the Australians at Hamel, like the Germans before, the Australians comprehensively work out how to break this infernal question, deadlock on the Western Front, the most tricky question pretty much ever posed to military planners in the history of the world. Now, as we all know, the First World War was just a time of tough generals sending working class lads to the slaughter, marching them in lines over a field to be machine gun, right? It was easy, I mean, come on. But let me tell you something, it wasn't like that. The First World War presented generals with the most fiendish collection of obstacles I think any generals have ever faced. Brand new weapon systems, aircraft that were less than 10 years old used on the battlefield for the first time. Can you imagine British generals trying to fight a massive cyber war 10 years after the internet was invented? It would not have gone well. I don't think it would go well now, but it would not have gone well at the time. Can you imagine, in fact, we're witnessing in Afghanistan, in Syria at the moment, using drones on the battlefield in titanic numbers when drones are still a brand new technology? Imagine, these are the things that were going on at the time. These were things that were presented to people like my great-grandfather, who was a slightly doddery old divisional commander on the outbreak. That man had spent his childhood riding horses around looking for Zulus on the South African veldt. And now I've read his diary, he goes, bloody hell, I saw an airship the other day, they're amazing things. He's meant to be in charge of the situation. It was brutal, but in those 4 short years, rather than being a time of stagnation and conservative thinking, military tactics, technology changed as never before or since in world history. You go from the tank being a crazed idea of, among other people, he tried to take the credit for it, Winston Churchill, but other people as well, in November 1914, September, let's get a tractor and put some armor plate, let's get a battleship, put wheels on it and drive it at the enemy, right? It is on the battlefield 2 years later in September 16, from idea to battlefield. Pretty extraordinary. And that goes lots of other ways I'll talk to you about today as well. So at Hamel, on the 4th of July, almost this week in 1918, almost 100 years ago now, something completely extraordinary happened. And that is the Australians launched their attack. In command was a very unlikely person called John Monash, who was a Jewish, middle-class engineer from Australia. And as such, was not liked by many people. He was not cut from the same cloth as many of his. He was also not an alpha. He didn't cut the figure that Australians expected of their military commanders. He was a quiet, unassuming man. In fact, throughout 1918, I'll share a funny story with you. The Australian Prime Minister had been subjected to a lengthy campaign to discredit Monash involving fake news. The Australian Prime Minister visited the front line just before the Battle of Hamel to fire Monash, but arrived there and found that everyone was in love with the man. And he worked out that it had been the campaign of fake news dissemination by, among others, a journalist called Keith Murdoch. Funny old world. Anyway, so I keep thinking I should be waving this around. In response to the disaster at the Battle of Somme, I know it's difficult to talk about the Somme like this, but the Somme was an extraordinary learning experience for the British Army. Pretty bloody lesson, but it was a learning experience. And the following year, new tactics and advice have been produced, especially for junior officers. And you would see this happening at Hamel. No longer would a battalion commander, some old man sort of my age, give out these new like trench mortars and flamethrowers and Lewis guns. That would all be sent down to the lowest level possible. It would be given to sergeants and second lieutenants, and it would be kept with them. And they would be given discretion over how they were used. Things like grenade launchers. All of these things, by the way, are brand new. In 1914, when Dad's grandpa and my great-grandpa commanded the Battle of Lakato, men had a rifle. The guns were light guns. They were just 100 or so meters behind them, not unlike Waterloo. The men in the rifles dug a tiny bit of trench that they have to. They didn't really like digging, apparently. The British particularly quite lazy. They just thought they'd stand up and shoot or lie down. The Germans marched in lines towards them. If Wellington had been, and my great-grandfather rode around the battlefield on a horse, if Wellington had been on the battlefield, it wouldn't have been completely unknown to him. Less than four years later now at Hamel, we've got new weapons. We've got light machine guns, Lewis guns, that people can carry forward into action, which means that rather than just being able to fire 15, 16, 20 rounds a minute with your rifle, you can now spurt 600 rounds a minute out. Unimaginably different. You've got flamethrowers. You've got light trench mortars. So if you come against a strong point, you can stop there, take cover, and then lob indirect fire onto that strong point. You've got, for the first time ever, wireless radios in action. People going, actually, can you stop shelling us, please? Rather than sending some bloke running back or a carrier pigeon. Things have changed incredibly rapidly. They're still working out how to make this, how to build it in. Also, most importantly of all, is the artillery. Britain was good at making big guns. It's got a big navy with big guns, and after it didn't have any factories, didn't have enough factories doing it in 1914, but it gears itself up, and by 18, it's churning out big guns. And they are very useful for smashing German artillery. And if you read German artillery diaries through the First World War, you see them saying at the beginning, these Brits are completely useless, absolute turkey shoot. So by the end, it is an unending misery for them. And the big guns, because as Napoleon said, it is with the artillery that one makes war. Guns firing explosives and shrapnel can cover an area the size of this field consistently and without stopping with supersonic fragments of razor-sharp steel indefinitely. Indefinitely. Trains can bring up those shells and you just keep firing the big guns. So they killed most people in the First World War. As you're crossing no man's land, you're walking through, and the German artillery knows exactly where it needs to land those shells because they've been sitting there 3 years. They've pre-sighted all their artillery. They just flick the switch and it just turns into an absolute firestorm. So the British have got to neutralize those guns, and they do so by harnessing technology. They've got new microphones that can tell the approximate range, the direction, the caliber of a gun just by the sound of its discharge. They've got aerial reconnaissance. They've plotted where all the guns are. And that means that when the artillery battle starts, this giant counter-battery barrage goes down on the German guns, particularly using gas and high explosives. So the gas shells land on all these enemy guns. You've got to put your horrible gas mask on. You're staggering around. It completely attrites your willingness to go on, your ability to fire and reload your own weapon, and then you're also pounding them with high explosives as well. All troops were briefed in massive detail. None of this like, right, line up there, follow your sergeant, see you later. All the troops, they're rehearsing. They're building enemy defense. They're rehearsing. They've been told exactly what they're expected to achieve. Air superiority, the Allies threw tons of aircraft into this battlefield. They strafed German positions from the ground. They dropped supplies to the Australians. They were able to report back. Totally different world to get the air spotter. I've read his diary at the Battle of Lakato 4 years before. He's just flying around with no method of communicating anybody on the ground at all, flying around going, that looks pretty miserable down there, having a terrible time, unable to intervene in that battle at all. And then there were the tanks. The tanks rumbling along at a titanic speed of 5 miles an hour, able to work with infantry. At Cambrai the year before, tanks had gone into battle. They had cruised up the hill towards Cambrai. It had been a big success, but the infantry had been 500 meters back, 400 meters back. The tanks had just gone on. Everyone was like, let's see how they do. Now the tanks, the infantry were working together. The infantry were sheltering behind the tanks. They were talking to the tank crews. They were working with the tanks. They could call their attention. They worked together. Hundreds and hundreds of troops would be able to shelter behind a tank. So at 3:10 a.m. in the morning, because you accurately judge your artillery fire, you've plotted where you want to land those shells because of all these new techniques, these ranging techniques. You don't need to do what you did at the Somme, was fire a week of artillery at the enemy, just hoping to destroy everything and hope for the best. You now keep dead silent until the moment it goes. You use surprise. So at 3:10 a.m., bang, this unimaginable artillery barrage begins. Germans taken completely by surprise. Instantly, as the big guns are firing on the German artillery, keeping them suppressed, other guns are firing a creeping barrage. This is one of the most technically pleasing aspects of the First World War. A barrage, when you create a wall of high explosives and steel and smoke that advances at the same pace that your troops are advancing at. So they start walking, and this thing just moves forward, destroying everything, but almost more importantly, creating a kind of curtain through which, so if Germans are in the dugout, they say, we're being shelled, let's all get in our dugouts. Okay, that's fine, we're down here. By the time the barrage lifts, they've got a bunch of Aussies at the top of their dugouts, ask them politely to surrender. So that's how that works. So they move forward, and the Australians used to say, there we go, the firing is blown. The Australians used to say, if you weren't taking casualties from your own barrage, you weren't close enough. You wanted to be able to touch your own barrage. It was coming over your head and landing right in front of you, churning up the ground and creating this curtain of steel. So they move forward, it goes well. There's a great moment when a cooperation between tanks and infantry, first time it happens really. The 43rd South Australian Battalion came under heavy machine gun fire. A sergeant spotted a tank. He ran over, ran to the door at the back. You can see a Mark IV tank up there. It's got a little door at the back. He rang a little bell, ding, 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 ding. They went, yeah, you're right, mate. And he went, can you go and deal with that machine gun post? And they're like, yeah, sure. And the tank rumbled over, and using its six-pound guns, its machine guns, and sometimes just crushing with its tracks, it was able to deal with that machine gun post. So the first, you know, infantry-tank cooperation, which is now the bedrock, of course, of all modern military operations. Tanks also carry forward supplies. They are being used as sort of armoured personnel carriers or carrier tanks. One tank did the job, it was calculated, of 1,000 porters. 1,000 porters. An officer arrived, he arrived at the front line, and he found a big stack, 134 coils of barbed wire, 45 sheets of corrugated iron, 50 kind of jerry can things of water, 150 trench mortar bombs, 20 boxes of grenades, and 10,000 rounds of ammo, all just been brought by a tank coming across the battlefield. So that problem that the stormtroopers had earlier in March, when they're fighting quite well and doing good advances, they end up knackered, out of ammunition, not knowing where they are, hungry, terrified. Now you've got the reinforcements, the supplies getting pushed forward as quickly as possible. It's a revolution in military affairs. You've also got planes dropping medical and ammo supplies to the soldiers on the front line. 12 aircraft dropped 1,200 rounds by parachute from 800 meters, first time it ever happened. The planes would fly low over the battlefield, they'd toot their horns, boop, boop, and then the Australians would let flares off to show where they were. The planes either then had wireless sets in them, or more often, they would fly back to HQ, and then they would drop the updated maps of positions of the frontline units down to HQ. So the whole process took about 10 minutes. Unimaginable a few years before. So that meant that HQ could say, right, we're going to move our emphasis on artillery. Because, of course, you know, if you're firing on a pre-existing timetable, half the time, if your troops do better than they expect, you end up shelling your own troops. It's tragic. They also experimented with radios. They experimented with rockets. They'd put a message in a rocket and fire it off. Most of the time, they didn't work. They incinerated the message. And carrier pigeons. All tanks had carrier pigeons, which sound quite funny, but are actually totally amazing and work. They achieved their objectives on that morning in 93 minutes. Monash had promised it would take 90. So 3 minutes out, which for the First World War is remarkable. They advanced a mile and a half. Their losses were 1,400 men. Montgomery later called Monash the greatest commander on the Western Front. So that made everyone sit up and take notice. The Germans were worried, and the Brits and the French thought, let's do something bigger. So on the 8th of August, the Battle of Amiens occurred, which is one of the most important battles in world history, and we should all be marking its 100th anniversary this year. Monash said he wanted to plan a bigger offensive. His boss, Rawlinson, went to Haig, said, "We're ready to go. Give us the Canadian Corps. We can do this." Haig said, went to Marshal Foch, the overall commander of the Allies, and said, we want to get back on the front foot. We can launch a full-scale offensive. Foch said, "Okay, but you've got to take some French troops with you." Monash said, "We don't want the French." And they end up taking the French. Now, I'm not just saying this is a half Canadian, but the Canadians were used with the Aussies for the first time, and that was one potent cocktail. The Germans came to rue the day. The Canadians at that stage regarded as crack troops. Obviously, my great-grandfather, Robert McMillan, was a Canadian in the First World War, and they regarded as crack troops. They regarded as crack troops so much so that in planning for Amiens, the Canadians sent a battalion and lots of radio sets up to Flanders and made themselves as obvious as possible. Because the Germans went, wherever the Canadians are is where they're going to be attacking next. And so they used a lot of signals, war games, if you like. They built aerodromes up in Flanders so the Germans would see them. They went to every effort to disguise, unlike the Somme, where they just built a massive, massive supply dump in full view of the Germans. Everything was being done. They poured sand all over paved roads so vehicles and men would move quietly. They only moved men at night. You slept in a hedge during the day. Every time you moved tanks up to the front, planes would buzz overhead to drown out the noise of tank engines. Everything that could be done was done. There was in everyone's pay book, a note had been stuck saying, "Keep your mouth shut." Nice and simple. And above all, they brought massive firepower to bear on this section of front line. Massive firepower. So, on a 13-mile front, 1,400 field guns and 600, so around 2,000 guns, of which 700 were heavy guns, okay? None of them fired any ranging shots. They didn't get there and get their eye in, fire a few shots, yeah, it's looking all right. They did all of their ranging and preparation in maths. The whole thing was physics and maths. They knew that when they fired their first shot, it would land where they wanted it, without having warmed up the barrel, without having seen, you know, this is how far you've moved on. So that compares, by the way, so your 700 heavy guns, about 2,000 guns in all, compares with the Somme 2 years earlier when you had 400 heavy guns and about 1,500 guns in all, and that was a longer front line. The Somme was over a longer front, so you've got far more guns, far more heavy guns crammed into a smaller area. And this time, they're not firing dud shells and they're going to hit what they hit. They're going to hit what they're aiming at. 580 tanks were brought up. The Germans were not expecting an attack in this sector, and 2,000 aircraft were assembled for this assault against 350 Germans. So it's overwhelming force, surprise, and meticulous planning. It's beginning to sound very, very modern. On the 8th of August, 1918, at 4:20 in the morning, without any preliminary barrage, the morning was foggy, which was perfect. A gigantic, gigantic gunfire opened up on the German lines. 45 minutes later, and the British, the Americans, particularly the Canadians, the Australians attacked. 45 minutes later, the French attacked. The barrage started 200 yards from the Allied troops. So this idea of this creeping barrage, and every 3 minutes, it would move forward 100 yards. So you had 3 minutes to close the 100 yards, and then the barrage would move with you. And these Australians and Canadians, particularly in the centre of the line, were staying right up close to the barrage. Scout troops would go forward in open formation, using the landscape, using their brains, avoiding you know, strong positions. Then came the tanks with the infantry behind them, working together, as I talked about at Hamel. The tanks, as I say, they had machine guns and they had 6-inch guns in their sponsors, so they're bringing firepower to the infantry as well. The infantry are also carrying all this extra stuff that was unimaginable a few years before. So basically what modern technology has done, surprise, surprise, like we're all walking around with supercomputers in our pockets now, what modern technology has done is miniaturize firepower, make it more portable, and make it more usable for individuals as they're going forward. It's the same, it's been the same ever since the Industrial Revolution, the same happening today, when one unit today could destroy the whole of Napoleon's Grand Army without breaking a sweat. By 7:30 in the morning, they'd advanced 2 miles, they'd captured the front line. There's one great story. Lieutenant Percy Eade's Mark V tank came to the rescue of some Australians that were struggling to overcome some machine gun nests. It knocked out 6 machine gun nests in half an hour. It advanced up towards them, it blasted them with its guns, it crushed the barbed wire that its caterpillar tracks, and it apparently did crush one or two of the crews itself. It single-handedly secured one this particular village, and he gave the village to the Australian infantry to make sure things were done right and proper. Percy Ede was handed an authorization receipt by the Australians. It's like you guys queuing, it's done properly. Then what happens is you advance too much, and then you're a bit knackered, so you stop, and then supporting units leapfrog you. So a whole new bunch of people come through you, and the creeping barrage starts again, and the same process continues. Now, eventually, of course, you get to a point where you're actually breaking through German defences. And so for the first time, well, a little bit at Cambrai the year before, but for the first proper time on the Western Front, you start to break out into the green fields beyond. One German divisional officer and his staff were captured having breakfast. And for the first time, horsemen are able to charge through the gap and start sowing anarchy behind German lines, along with light tanks. Now, also armoured cars. There was one Austin armoured car. It was armed with two machine guns. It couldn't really get through mud, but once you towed it across the back, once it got on a road, 35 miles an hour, it's a proper vehicle, and they went tearing around. It burst into a core HQ, and it captured a map of the Hindenburg Line, this massive defensive fortification, which I need to tell you about in the next 15 minutes. Crikey. Which would prove very useful later in the summer. I've got to tell you, though, about Musical Box. Our American guests won't understand why we give our big, tough military equipment such unbelievably lame names, but we do, I'm afraid. If it had been in America, it would be called something awesome. But Musical Box is the single most remarkable armoured vehicle in British military history. It was a Whippet tank. It surged forward, three crew, and it's inside. It could travel at an astonishing 8 miles an hour. And really, it was one of the most incredible adventures of the First World War, so I'll tell you about it now. It took on a German battery. Two Mark V tanks were in front of it, smoking. A German gun battery destroyed two big tanks. It surged forward, went round the flank, and attacked the battery from the rear, killing and disabling the crew. Then cavalry patrols. Cavalry was great, except obviously when they came against machine guns, you had the old problem. So they were hiding in the woods. Musical Box surged out of the woods, cleared that machine gun. The cavalry were able to keep streaming forward. Then it ended up clearing German rifle pits, for the first time in history, an armoured vehicle was operating with impunity behind the lines of the enemy. This was blitzkrieg tactics, but in 1918. It arrived at a German camp as the enemy was packing up in preparation for flight, and it just drove along these line of tents, like a hen in a fox house, just blasting everything to bits. It was like a Hollywood film. Killing or wounding up to 100 people. After a nine-hour rampage, one of the slight problems with Musical Box is it stored all its spare fuel on the roof in jerry cans. And it was incredibly hot in August. It was incredibly hot in tanks anyway. The three crew were completely overwhelmed. They had to put on their own gas masks because of the fumes from the engine and now all this petrol leaking through the roof above them. It was finally hammered by a German machine gun, hit by a shell. It caught on fire. The commander managed to drag his two crewmates out. One died, their clothes were on fire, he managed to put the fire out. The Germans came over and gave them one hell of a kicking and then took them prisoner. So two of the crew survived the war. But it was a vision of the future. By the end of the day, a 15-mile gap had been punched in the German front line, 8 miles in depth. The Australians and Canadians had liberated the most territory. 110 square miles of France had been liberated. The Canadians, I must say, had actually got the record. They advanced 8 miles. The Australians, 7. The French, 5. And the British, 2. But anyway, there was some tricky geography up there. Don't worry, it looked fine. The Brits come into it later. 13,000 prisoners taken. Probably the most important thing of all is that Germans started surrendering in large numbers. It should be said that the German army was not what it once was. So although these were the most remarkable set of victories in British history, it should be remembered that the German army had been terribly badly beaten by March 18. They were hearing accounts of their families being starved at home, their morale was low, and they were very worried about the Americans. So it was certainly true that the Germans were not the unimaginably tough opposition they had been, for example, at the Somme in 1916. There were perhaps 30,000 German losses in all. Ludendorff, the chief of staff and de facto commander of the German army, had effectively a nervous breakdown when he heard the news. He called it the blackest day of the German army, and he realized on the 8th of August, 1918, that it was over. But he kept fighting, he had no other choice. In the following days, though, the tanks broke down, the same thing happened, the infantry would outrun the artillery, things bogged down, the same lethal, the logic of the Western Front sadly bogged the operation down, so Haig called a stop to it and attacked elsewhere. And this would be the answer to 1918, the 100 days, that was the start of the 100 days, by the way, so about 42 minutes into the talk, I've now launched into what the talk is about. Hope you enjoyed the preamble. And Haig launched a series of punches up and down the Western Front. The British attacked Albert on the 21st of August, driving the Germans back. They took Bapaume on the 29th. It'd be very useful to have a map up here for this bit, so bear with me. And the Australians crossed the Somme at the Battle of Mont Saint-Quentin on the 31st. By the 2nd of September, the Germans were back in the Hindenburg Line, where they'd started that spring. But they'd been brutally battered on the way back. However, they were now back in the Hindenburg Line. My other favourite German word from World War I, the Siegfriedstellung, which was an incredible fortification they'd built over an entire winter. Barbed wire stacked so high and wide it looked like a building in its own right. Underground concrete bunkers, telephone lines wired deep beneath the ground so you could call in artillery strikes on the enemy as it approached you. It was a brutal, brutal proposition. But the scene was set for the Hindenburg Line, the penetration of the Hindenburg Line. And yet again, Monash would play the leading role. By this time, the Australian Corps was battered, and there were actually a few mutinies. They'd felt they'd done too much. But Monash was talked into it, and he was given two giant American divisions. American divisions, twice the number of Australian divisions, lots and lots of young, keen guys. The Australians placed lots of key NCOs and officers into those divisions as advisors. Monash said before this battle, it would be more a matter of engineering and organization than of fighting. That turned out to be not entirely true, but that does give you a sense of what battle had become in 1918. It had become massive positional warfare involving engineering as much as, but also requiring, of course, courage and the human element. But it was like nothing that had ever happened before. The bombardment that began it, I've said this a few times today, but it was the heaviest British bombardment of the First World War to that point. 1,600 guns fired, 600 of them heavy. They fired 1 million shells, and this is not over a week, this is over the space of a few minutes. They rained 1 million shells down on the enemy. This time, unlike the Somme 2 years before, when they advanced forward and all the Brits found dud shells hanging like Christmas decorations on the barbed wire, not very pleased about that. These shells were designed to blow up just above the ground, shattering high explosives and shrapnel down that would sever the barbed wire, that would beat down the barbed wire and carve huge trenches in the barbed wire that the Brits could then march through. So that's a technological change as well. Two American divisions attacked, followed by the Aussies, only with 150 tanks. So this great battle was not actually about tanks. This was about infantry cooperating with artillery. And it was very, very, very difficult terrain. And the British were to the south, and they'd been given the toughest sector. Not much success was expected of them. One American division on the left failed to capture its objectives. The 107th Infantry Regiment sustained the highest casualties of any US unit in the First World War. On the right, the American division did better, but they didn't meet their timetable. They were lacking behind, which meant the artillery was unable to work with the infantry, and there was terrible fog, so the planning went out the window, and it became a terrible battle of small units just fighting for advantage. 10 tanks were knocked out in 15 minutes by German field guns, so the tanks were not having a good day either. Monash wrote about them. In the best tradition of generals blaming other people on the First World War on the Western Front, Monash wrote, "I fear the American casualties have been heavy, but it's all their own fault." Now, to the south, the British attacked across the St. Quentin Canal, which is not a canal like the old Bristol and Avon up there. It is a canal at the bottom of a giant cutting. It's like the Grand Canyon. It's a massive anti-tank ditch with a canal at the bottom, with enemy positioned all over both sides of it. This is why no one had much hopes for the British. But after a massive artillery barrage, the Brits advanced. The Staffordshire men, I don't have any family links to Staffordshire, so I'm being nice about them, but this is not bias. They led the way and what they did there is one of the most remarkable and successful actions in the history of the British Army. They crossed the German trenches on the near side of the canal, staying close to the artillery barrage. They then crossed the canal, and they then worked their way up the other side of the canal and onto the other side. They floated across the canal on 3,000 life belts that they'd nicked from Channel ferries and other pontoons. Some of the Staffordshire men seized a bridge. They might advance so quickly they seized one of the bridges across the canal before the Germans could fire it, which was decisive. By the end of the day, 5,000 Germans and prisoners had been taken in the whole battle, and the British Staffordshire, the British 46th Division, had taken 4,000 of them. So 80% of the German casualties that day had been inflicted by the British. After they did that success, the 32nd Division crossed, among them a man called Wilfred Owen. A few days later, he would win at the military cost for showing conspicuous gallantry, showing fine leadership, behaving most gallantly, said his citation. It was all done on schedule, and even more remarkably, that astonishing attack had cost only 800 British casualties. It is a totally forgotten, unbelievably complete victory, one that Monash, the Australian commander, called astonishing. So by the 2nd of October 1918, the Hindenburg Line had a giant hole torn in it. After that successful first attack, though, on the 29th, the end of September, Hindenburg went up to the Kaiser and told the Kaiser, who was astonished, who'd only been fed fake news, he told an astonished Kaiser that the war is lost, you must ask for an armistice. The Australians had done that. So the fighting, though, went on. The German army kept reeling back through Belgium. The fighting went on. The Australians were withdrawn from the line after that terrible battle breaking through the Hindenburg Line. They played no further part in the war to rest and recuperate. The Germans retreated. Wilfred Owen was killed crossing the Sambre-Oise Canal 1 week before the armistice. He was leading his men across the canal. He'd had a reputation as a great war poet by then. I think he didn't want people to think he was being a bit of a thesp or, you know, shirking as an artist, shirking his duty. So he became conspicuously brave in those last weeks of the war, and he paid for it with his life. It was a week to the hour before the armistice broke out, and his mother in Shrewsbury received notification that Wilfred Owen had died a week later as the church bells in Shrewsbury were ringing out to mark the end of the war. Now, I think, I'll just tell you some interesting stuff. So the war obviously comes to an end on the 11th of November, partly in response. As we know, the Germans have given up. The German leadership is convinced they've been defeated. But what their allies also collapse in spectacular style. On the 24th of October, the Austro-Hungarians collapse on a river in northern Italy. The Allies launch an offensive, and Austria, it's a straw that breaks the camel's back. It leads to fundamental collapse. The Bulgarians had collapsed in October, meaning that the road to Constantinople was open. Allied troops could now threaten the capital of the Ottoman Empire. Damascus had fallen to the Arabs in September, so Germany's allies were collapsing. On the Western Front, Germany was being pushed back inexorably, the German high command. And, as you know, German civilians, the German fleet in the North Sea, and the German civilians started mutinying and rebelling. Germany was knocked out of the war, facing civilizational collapse of its own. On the 11th of November, and the days leading up to it, there had been talks, of course, and it was decided it was a nice time to stop the guns on the 11th hour of the 11th of November, for no reason other than its poetic sound. But that meant tens of thousands of men were killed or wounded in those last hours of the war, completely unnecessarily. George Lawrence Price from Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, a long way from home, he was killed. The last British Empire soldier killed at 10:58 on the 11th of November. The last American to die was Henry Gunter, killed at 10:59. Bizarrely, he charged towards the Germans, the astonished Germans, who knew that the ceasefire was a minute away. So it seems to have been a suicidal decision. The last British soldier was George Edwin Ellison. He had fought all the way from Mons in 1914 to be killed on the morning of the 11th of November in 1918. He was killed at 9:30 in the morning. The first British soldier to be killed in the war was the 16-year-old John Parr at Mons. The last British soldier was killed only a couple of miles away from him, and they're now buried opposite each other, facing each other, in St. Sophorian Cemetery in Mons. It is said that's coincidental. I just can't believe it is. But it's come to symbolise the futility and the stagnation of the First World War, that the first Briton killed was killed really only metres away from where the last Briton was killed 4 years later, totally by chance. That is, I've just got the 100 days in under the time by truncating the 100 days part of the 100 days. But thank you very much. If you want to ask any questions, I would love to hear you now. Have we got microphones? We got microphones. Hands are going up. People are running. There you go, sir. We'll try and get around everybody. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.